are they going to start paying a share of development cost? No. Okay. That tells me they're still holding back, but they want to learn more.
Reaction to the state's new gas line deal with China. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 9th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers work to strengthen rules against sexual harassment.
We just need to make sure, number one, that a stop is put to it, but human beings are human beings, and when they break the rules, we want to be able to react quickly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Going without health insurance could be financially devastating. Healthcare bills are the leading cause of personal bankruptcy. Open enrollment for 2018 plans is November 1st through December 15th. A household of four with an annual income of less than $123,000 may qualify for federal tax credits to help cover premium costs. Get signed up for health insurance at healthcare.gov today. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Alaska isn't getting any immediate funding from a deal with Chinese companies to develop the state's gas line mega project. But Alaska Governor Bill Walker and State Gas Line Corporation head Keith Meyer say they are encouraged by a deal they signed in Beijing. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more details on the agreement and how Alaskans are responding to it.
As U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping looked on, Alaska's trade delegation signed an agreement with the China-owned oil giant Sinopec, one of the country's banks, and a sovereign wealth fund. Keith Meyer says the state has been trying to woo companies in China for months.
So we've been through the courtship. We're now engaged.
The deal links Alaska's gas pipeline project to China's biggest state oil company as a potential buyer, the Bank of China as a lender, and the Chinese Investment Corporation, a sovereign wealth fund with deep pockets. Right now, Meyer says Alaska will stay in control of the project and hasn't asked for any financial help from its new partners. He says they've given themselves a little over a year to hammer out a final agreement. The state wants a final investment decision by 2019 so it can break ground and bring the project online by 2025. Larry Persily is a former federal pipeline coordinator for Alaska, and he says this agreement with the Chinese market is non-binding and not much different than agreements the state has signed in the past.
MOUs, letters of interest, letters of intent, they're made up names. They don't mean anything legally. I mean, you could call it a joint development agreement or MOU or a memorandum of cooperation. I look more at what's underneath it. Are they going to start paying a share of development costs? No. Okay. That tells me they're still holding back, but they want to learn more.
And there are some other hurdles ahead. Alaska doesn't control the gas. The producers on the North Slope, BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil do. Up until last year, those three companies were partnered with the state in developing the pipeline, but they stopped pursuing the project and let the state take over. At the time, they said the market conditions were unfavorable. And even though their gas is crucial for the final project, Walker says they didn't really have much to do with this deal.
This agreement is for a infrastructure project, and the producers, that's what they transitioned over to us in February of 2016. And so the producers don't really have a role in the infrastructure portion of this. We'll certainly continue to negotiate with them on the gas offtake without question. But as far as the infrastructure itself, we're not asking them to be a participant in that at all.
Don Patience at BP says the company looks forward to understanding the terms of the agreement and the role and vision for the gas owners. Natalie Lohman at ConocoPhillips says the company supports the state's plan to try and push the project forward, and it intends to sell its gas. The state's gas line corporation has had an increasingly troubled relationship with Alaska's legislature, which funnels money into the corporation and the project. Last year, lawmakers in the House and Senate attempted to defund the agency and cut its budget, and they have repeatedly asked for more information and transparency from the state-run project. Anchorage Republican Kathy Giesel heads the powerful Senate Resources Committee. She says she still needs more details.
I take the role in this scenario of the loan officer at the credit union. And you come to me with this great idea with lots of backup. And my answer to you is, boy, that sounds like a great idea. I'm going to dig into the details and we'll talk again.
Anchorage Democrat Garen Tarr says the deal is a positive step. Tarr heads the House Resources Committee. And while she is encouraged, she says she's not sure the deal is enough to convince the legislature to funnel more money into the Gasland Corporation.
Well, I think at this point, the feeling in the legislature is that the remaining $70 to $80 million is what AGDC has to work with right now to get to a decision point.
A substantive deal on the state-run Gasland project could be a game changer for Alaska's struggling oil-based economy. The pipeline would cost at least $43 billion to build, and its construction would temporarily add thousands of jobs to the state's economy. The more than 800-mile-long pipeline would connect two oceans and pipe LNG from Prudhoe Bay to the Kenai Peninsula before loading it onto tankers and shipping it to Asia. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Both chambers of the Alaska legislature are seeking to make changes to their sexual harassment policies. Lawmakers said today they want to increase training to prevent harassment and improve the procedures for addressing allegations. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on what the Senate and House are doing.
The national reckoning with sexual harassment has reached Juneau. Senate leaders have asked legislative staff to help implement mandatory workplace conduct training. In a letter to the legislature's top legal advisor and human resources director, the Senate leaders also asked for procedures to handle complaints beyond the reach of political influence. Senate President Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, says the letter was prompted by incidents both inside and outside of Alaska.
In light of what's going on all over the country, and there's some things been swirling around in this Capitol as well, what has dawned on me is that, and leadership, is that we don't have sufficient procedures in place to deal with any kind of workplace issues that might have to do with positional power or sexual harassment.
House leaders say they have been undertaking a similar review for a few weeks. Anchorage Republican Representative Gabrielle Ledoux says the current policy hasn't been revised since 2000.
It really doesn't seem to have any teeth or any mechanisms for reporting.
Ledoux says the policy should cover both workplace incidents and those involving legislators' behavior outside of the workplace. And she says it should cover both sexual harassment and other physical harassment.
We need a far more robust policy than we have right now.
Ledoux says she discussed a joint policy with a Senate staff member.
I have no control over the Senate, but I will guarantee you that the House will adopt something.
Kelly says he's not envisioning a policy that would apply outside of the workplace. The Senate president says he wants to have a procedure to address complaints that would lead to a quick resolution.
We just need to make sure, number one, that a stop is put to it. I hope we can. But human beings are human beings, and when they break the rules, we want to be able to react quickly.
Leaders from both chambers would like to have new policies in place by early next legislative session in January. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaska's U.S. senators are among those issuing conditional calls for Alabama's Republican nominee for Senate to leave the race. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan say Roy Moore should step aside if the claims of sexual abuse made against him are true. The Washington Post today reports the on-the-record account of a woman who says Moore asked her out and had sexual contact with her when she was 14. He was in his 30s at the time. Sullivan, in a written statement, calls the alleged behavior sickening. Moore beat Senator Luther Strange in a Republican primary and is running in a special election next month. According to Alabama law, it's too late to remove Moore's name from the ballot. So Murkowski has a suggestion for Strange. Murkowski told reporters she's encouraging Strange to run as a write-in candidate. That strategy worked for Murkowski after she lost her primary in 2010, and Strange is easier to spell than Murkowski. First Lady Melania Trump is stopping in Alaska tomorrow for a visit with members of the military at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson in Anchorage. In a release, J-Bear spokesperson says the First Lady is visiting the Month of the Military Family Celebration held on base. The event is put on by an Air Force support unit and will include games, story time, as well as demonstrations by local teen groups. Trump is returning from a diplomatic trip to Asia with the president. She's expected to be on the ground in Anchorage for several hours. Alaska is a frequent refueling stop for U.S. officials traveling between Washington, D.C. and Asia. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, senators opposed to opening up ANWR struggle to muster outrage from anti-drilling voters.
We really sincerely hope that there is a way that we can illuminate for the American people that this choice is being made.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
In the U.S. Senate, opponents of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge are having trouble getting the word out. Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington State today lamented that the refuge drilling proposal isn't drawing public outrage like it did more than a decade ago.
Listen, I know it's a busy news cycle we live in, but last time this issue captured the public's attention, and it's been out of the public's attention for a long time.
Cantwell spoke at a press conference at the Capitol, asked what her strategy is. She said she hoped the reporters present would write a lot to let people know Arctic refuge drilling could be tucked into the tax cut plan that is grabbing bigger headlines.
We really sincerely hope that there is a way that we can illuminate for the American people that this choice is being made.
Cantwell's appeal for attention seems a far cry from 2005 when anti-drilling voters jammed congressional phone lines and knocked on doors in the districts of wavering House members. Senator Lisa Murkowski plans to chair a debate in the Energy Committee on the drilling proposal Wednesday. The measure cleared one hurdle this week. The Congressional Budget Office determined lease sales in ANWR would meet the revenue target of $1 billion for the federal treasury within 10 years. The proposal calls for a 50-50 revenue split with the state, so according to the CBO estimate, Alaska would also get $1 billion in the first decade from lease sales in the refuge. The University of Alaska Board of Regents meets today and tomorrow in Anchorage to vote on the university budget and propose tuition increases. The agenda includes approval of the university's budget for the next fiscal year. The proposed budget is just under $920 million. About a third of that would be made up of state appropriations. State funding to the university has declined by about $60 million since 2014, forcing cutbacks in academic programming, faculty, and staff across campuses. Regents will also consider a request for $50 million from the state to address the university's deferred maintenance backlog. A 10% tuition increase over the next 2 years is on the table. Regents will decide whether to raise tuition at most campuses by 5% in both the 2019 and 2020 academic years. Tuition at Kodiak College and Prince William Sound College would increase by nearly twice as much in order to even out tuition rates across the university system. UA President Jim Johnson will also present on Phase 3 of Strategic Pathways, the university's comprehensive cost-cutting plan. Regents also will receive an update on how the university has improved its response to sexual harassment and assault allegations. The board meetings are live-streamed. The sea cucumber fishery in Southeast opened for harvest in the beginning of October. It's now halfway through its season, and much like salmon this year, it looks like the state's sea cucumber harvest is also finding success on the global market. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Out of all the divers in Southeast, most touched down in Ketchikan. Bo Meredith, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Assistant Area Management Biologist for Commercial Fisheries in Ketchikan, says about 160 divers recently made landings in Southeast. He says 100 of those were in Ketchikan. He says the other region where divers harvest sea cucumbers is the Kodiak Management Area. In Kodiak, fewer than 20 divers this year participated for a total guideline harvest level of 140,000 pounds.
Southeast Alaska has this year 1.2 million pounds, but we're also, you know, you're talking about approaching the northern end of the geographic range for the red sea cucumber or California sea cucumber. So your productivity is not going to be as high, whereas Ketchikan is more in the prime zone of the geographic range for the sea cucumber as you head south.
He says this year there are 18 different harvest areas in Southeast, each with its own GHL. Once an area reaches its limit, it closes and reopens 3 years later. He says sea cucumbers take 3 to 4 years to mature, so that helps avoid overfishing. And that could play into why Alaska-sourced sea cucumbers are doing so well worldwide. Meredith says Alaska saw a change in the value of sea cucumbers about 6 years ago.
And all of a sudden the price went from about $2.50 a pound to $4 or $5 a pound. And it's been kind of steady at about $4 a pound. And then this year it shot up to $5 to $5.50 a pound.
Mike Erickson is the part owner of Alaska Glacier Seafoods, which processes sea cucumbers in Juneau. He believes poor management and overfishing in other countries could be why Alaska has risen in the ranks.
The supply is not meeting the demand, hence the price starts going up.
Erickson says, according to some of his buyers, Mexico used to be a big player in the global market.
And they still are, but they don't have the volumes that they had a couple, 3 years ago. You know, they've literally fished out some of their areas, so consequently, they don't have the supply that they had, and a lot of those cukes from Mexico were going to China.
He says Alaska Glacier Seafoods also sends many of its cukes to China.
You have a skin and you have a meat, so basically you extract the meat out of the skin, and then those two items kind of go to different markets. Like the skin will basically head to Asia, and the meat, even though we do sell some over into Hong Kong, we sell a fair amount of meat on the East Coast here in the U.S., believe it or not.
Erickson says he thinks sea cucumbers are doing so well, partly because of Fish and Game's management system. He also credits Alaska's reputation for pristine waters and a high-quality product. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
A Canadian power company's bid to acquire Juneau's privately owned electric utility has suffered a minor setback. As KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports, state regulators say Hydro One of Ontario will have to register with the state of Alaska, which restarts the regulatory process from scratch.
Hydro One applied to Alaska's utility regulator in September to approve its purchase of Juneau's power company. The filing with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska offered a rare opening for public comment before the months-long acquisition is finalized. The commission received 34 comments, most skeptical or outright hostile, to AEL&P's sale to the Canadian corporation. Hydro One and a sister entity requested the commission waive a requirement to obtain an Alaska business license. The RCA denied that waiver Wednesday. It wrote that the burden of registration is minor when weighed against the benefit to the public from the additional safeguards afforded by registration. RCA spokeswoman Grace Salazar said the company will need to start over.
His docket is closed, and if the entities file a new application, then we would start a whole new process. There may be a public comment period again.
AEL&P and its parent company released a statement through spokeswoman Debbie Driscoll.
This is not a substantive ruling on the merits of the application. It's an issue that can be remedied by refiling the application after Hydro One and Olympus Equity LLC register as foreign entities with the state of Alaska.
The rebooting of the public process comes as the Juneau Assembly continues to openly float the idea of making a bid for Juneau's utility.
Since the clock on this has reset, we have an opportunity to do some more studying before we jump in and make sure that we can protect people who buy electricity here in the capital city.
Assemblyman Jesse Keel chairs the city's finance committee. The assembly recently commissioned an $11,000 study on the underlying issues involved in the power company's sale. That was discussed at length at Wednesday's committee meeting.
There was broad agreement that the city needs to have a role in protecting Juneau ratepayers from unreasonable or unnecessary increases in the future. And with no local owner anymore, the risk of that goes up. But we didn't reach a consensus, take any votes about how to do that.
Renewable Juneau, a nonprofit organized to promote carbon alternatives, has expressed reservations over the deal. The group's Danielle Redman applauded the RCA's ruling.
We're very glad that there will be more time to understand what this proposed sale means for Juneau and what our options are going forward. And if the issue does come back before the commission, we'd like to see the Attorney General's office get involved and bring their resources to the table.
Until 3 years ago, AEL&P had been locally owned for more than a century. It was sold to Spokane-based Avista for $170 million. Hydro One announced earlier this year it was buying Avista for a reported $5.3 billion. It will need state and federal approval to complete the deal. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Now through December 15th is the open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace in Alaska. Plan costs have gone down this year. For free help to enroll, visit getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust. The University of Alaska's founders knew that to build a great state, we would need a great university. Today, UA offers more than 400 degrees and certificates with campuses from Kotzebue to Ketchikan. They are leaders in Arctic and Alaska research and dedicated to direct hands-on teaching, whether online, in the classroom, or in the field. Greatness awaits you. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
A marathon meeting of the Alaska Board of Game is underway in Anchorage. The body sets regulations for hunting and trapping. This year's meeting is focused on a set of broad regulations that would take effect across the state. In total, the board is considering 70 different proposals. They range from a proposed requirement that all Alaska hunters take a safety course to regulations on hunts for ceremonial potlatches. There are also some proposals unrelated to hunting. One is related to the trapping, neutering, and release of feral cats. Another would allow residents to own a small hedgehog-like creature called a tenrec, currently banned in Alaska. The seven board members will take public comments as well as testimony from state and federal agencies before voting on the measures. The game board meeting continues through next week. The deadline to sign up for public testimony is 10:30 Saturday morning. Four public buildings around Fairbanks will offer more electrical outlets in their parking lots next year to encourage customers to plug in their engine block heaters during cold snaps. The project is intended to help improve air quality. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the nearly 200 additional plug-ins will be installed next summer at the Carlson Center, Big Dipper Ice Arena, Noel Ween Library, and North Pole Branch Library. She says the greater availability of plug-ins should help reduce the amount of time required to warm up a vehicle at those parking lots in cold weather.
The goal is to reduce engine idle time for vehicles, and this, of course, we hope will result in lower vehicle emissions and improved air quality for our community.
Bailey says a federal grant will pay for the $3.2 million project, which will be done in two phases.
The Carlson Center would be one bid, and that would be $1.8 million, and the libraries and the Big Dipper would be a second construction project, and that would be approximately $1.4 million.
Plans call for 66 new plug-ins to be installed at both the Carlson Center and Big Dipper, 40 at the Noel Ween Library, and 25 at the North Pole Library. Bailey says the project will include installation of the new outlets and distribution panels and other work required to install the plug-ins.
Those are mounted onto concrete posts. There's also some jersey barriers to help protect the mounted electric plug-ins, and there will be things like trenching, replacing of asphalt that will be required when you're installing the new electrical wires, and then restriping parking lots so that they are actually in line with the plug-ins.
Bailey says the project's being coordinated through the Federal Highway Administration. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The federal government is scheduled to launch a new satellite later this month that will improve forecasts. JPSS-1 is a polar orbiting satellite that tracks dozens of things like temperature, moisture, snow cover, and even wildfires. Brian Brettschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment is eagerly awaiting the images and data from the new satellite. He says it will orbit pole to pole, crossing the equator 14 times each day.
And that provides, at any given location, at least two snapshots per day of what's going on in the atmosphere at that location.
And why is that important, especially for the far north?
Many people are familiar with seeing satellite images, say, of hurricanes. We saw that a lot this summer. And those come from geostationary satellites. So they're orbiting at 22,500 miles above the equator, and they circle the Earth at the same rate as the Earth rotates. But they have to be over the equator. And so here at Alaska, Arctic latitudes, and we're talking, say, from 55 degrees up to, say, 72 degrees up at the North Slope, we're out of the range of those satellites. Maybe in southeast, they're caught just a little bit, but north of 60 degrees, which is mainland Alaska, we're not in that. So we rely on other satellite imageries, some that are in what are called geosynchronous orbit, and some other satellites that don't catch us as frequently and where we're at an oblique angle. So having something that rotates a couple times a day that's going to get us higher resolution information is very important for forecast modeling and environmental modeling.
So this isn't just about forecasts. How do satellites actually help inform policy?
Since the first weather satellite was launched in 1966, we actually use that as a benchmark for monitoring, whether it's, say, for hurricanes, whether it's for sea ice, whether it's for ozone, you know, all these things that we assume we have this long, robust record for. Before the satellite era, in many cases, it was very fragmented. You know, we have records of coastal sea ice going back a long way. We have records of, you know, hurricanes striking the lower 48 a long time ago. But we don't really have this kind of uniform distribution across space until we have satellites. And so a lot of the decisions that we make from a public policy standpoint that involve environmental and earth science data, really, we start with the satellite era. And as we get better and better satellite imagery, we have more information to make good public policy decisions on.
Are you looking forward to seeing these first images?
It's kind of like being, you know, a kid in the candy store. There's all kinds of really fascinating information that you can see from these. So from the first generation satellite that's out there, there's really, in events like where we have a strong northerly cold outbreak, you can see silt blowing off of glaciers. You can see ash being blown off of volcanoes, previously deposited ash. So there's always something new and fascinating that you've never seen before when there's a new generation satellite that's launched.
Brian Bretschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. He checks in with Alaska's Energy Desk each week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney, Andrew Kitchenman, Jacob Resnick, and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes, Annie Fite, and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GCI Business, with complete GCI data solutions for Alaska's most important organizations. GCI is your partner in possibilities. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Family Education Loan so parents, a spouse, or grandparents can help students with the cost of college or training programs in or outside of Alaska. Interest rates are lower than the Federal Plus, and no credit is required. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management, the lead federal agency, is hosting a series of public scoping meetings on the proposed Ambler Road now through Tuesday, December 12th, in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and several communities near the Ambler Mining District. The BLM is developing an environmental impact statement and seeking public input. Learn more at blm.gov/AmblerRoadEIS. This message is sponsored by BLM.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.